You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of the Collected Works, Volume 17, Lectures, number 175, by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha, Human Life in a Cosmic Context. This is translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange, and this is Lecture 5. Given in Berlin on the 6th of March, 1917. I have spoken to you about the three meetings that feature in the human soul's biography in the course of its life between birth and death, and which bring it in the course of this life into connection with the spiritual worlds. We shall, today, return to this subject, which on the previous occasion we touched upon in a preparatory way in the form of an interpolation in somewhat greater detail. I pointed out that during the time between going to sleep and waking up, we experience a meeting, which usually takes place in the middle of the period of sleep. I say usually because the state of sleep is normally equivalent to the night. Thus, between going to sleep and waking up, we generally have an encounter with that world to which our spirit self is related, the world in which we place the beings from that hierarchy whom we refer to as the angels. So every time we pass through a period of sleep, we traverse that world where these beings dwell, a world which lies immediately above our physical world, and we refresh and strengthen our whole spiritual being through this meeting. Because this is so, because during sleep man is related to the spiritual world, a purely materialistic explanation, such as is attempted by ordinary science, can never provide a satisfactory interpretation. Much of what goes on within man can be explained from the changes that the body undergoes from waking up until going to sleep. And the attempt may be made to explain sleep from these changes. And yet there will always be something unsatisfactory about this, because sleep has to do with the meeting referred to, and hence with a person's relationship to the spiritual world. Thus it is precisely when we consider the state of sleep that we can see that where a person does not consciously seek a relationship to the spiritual world, he arrives at half-truths, which since ideas become deeds, bring a disturbing element to life, and also eventually, in a very real way, bring about great catastrophes in life. Half-truths. These are in some respects even worse than ideas that are completely erroneous, because people who formulate half-truths are very insistent about them, for they are able to prove them on the grounds that if they are even half-true, they can be proved. Moreover, they cannot be refuted, since the ideas are, after all, partly true. Such ideas distort life even more than completely erroneous ones, for their falsehood can be immediately discerned and recognized. One such half-truth, which has to some extent been abandoned by science today, but continues to have a considerable degree of support, is an idea that I have often alluded to before, that we sleep because we are tired. It is, we may indeed say, a half-truth. And it is supported by a half-true observation to which people appeal, namely, that the life of the day tires the body, and so one needs to sleep because one is tired. I have often drawn your attention in previous lectures to the fact that this interpretation of sleep can never explain why people with a private income, who have never done a stroke of work, often fall asleep at once when they hear stimulating discussions about events in the world around them. There is certainly no way of proving that they are tired, and that they have had to go to sleep because they have been slaving away is quite simply an erroneous or half-true observation. If we believe that we are compelled to go to sleep because we are tired, we are only half observing. We only see the limitations of our observation when we compare what we are observing from the one side with what can be observed from the other side, thus coming in contact with the other side of the truth. You will see presently what I mean. Going to sleep and waking up is a process of constant rhythmic alternation in an individual human life. However, man is a being who possesses freedom and who can therefore interfere with this rhythm more through circumstances than through anything that could be construed as free will, but such circumstances are the foundation of freedom. He can intervene in the course of events and is sometimes only all too glad to do so in the context of the rhythm of going to sleep and waking up. Another rhythm, which we have often combined with that of sleeping and waking, even though in ordinary consciousness they are not linked together in the right way, is the one that manifests itself in the course of the year, the alternation of summer and winter, if we leave the intermediate seasons out of account. It will not occur to anyone to say that during the summer the earth is making great efforts and is developing those forces which lead to the growth of plants and to much else besides, and that it then becomes tired and needs to have a rest in winter. Everyone would find such an idea to be absurd and will say that the coming of winter has absolutely nothing to do with the efforts of the earth in summer, but is caused by the sun being in a different spatial relationship to the region of the earth where winter makes its appearance. In the latter case, everything is being derived from outside, while with sleeping and waking, it is all a question of tiredness, which derives from within. Now the one is just as incorrect as the other. Or one could also say it is just as half-true as the other. The rhythm of sleeping and waking is the same kind of rhythm as that between winter and summer. It is no more true to say that we go to sleep only because we are tired than it is true that winter arrives because the earth has worn itself out during the summer. For both these events arise through the independent influence of a rhythm which is brought about by certain circumstances. The rhythm of sleeping and waking is governed by the need of the human soul to bring about the meeting with the spiritual world. If we were to say that we want to go to sleep and therefore feel tired, or if we were to say that we are entering a stage when we are in need of one part of the rhythm, the state of sleep, and therefore feel tired, we would be saying something more correct than to say that we must go to sleep because we are tired. Things become even clearer if we simply ask what the soul actually does when it is asleep. The unspiritual science of the present day does not have the right understanding, or even any real possibility, to answer such a question. When we are awake, we enjoy the outer world, for enjoyment accompanies us throughout our life. We do not merely enjoy the outer world when we experience a good meal by way of our palate, in which case the word enjoy has a quite particular connotation, but we enjoy the outer world throughout the time that we are awake, and the whole of life is at the same time enjoyment. Although there is much in the world that is unpleasant, and which is apparently not enjoyment at all, this is only an illusion. And we shall speak of this in a different context in the forthcoming lectures. When we are awake, we enjoy the outer world. When we are asleep, we, quite literally, enjoy our own selves. Just as we enjoy the outer world through our body, when our soul is dwelling in our body, so do we enjoy our own body when our soul is outside the body. For during the life between birth and death, we are connected with the body, even when, as souls, we are outside it. The essential point about the state of sleep, of ordinary, normal sleep, is that we are deeply immersed in our body, that we enjoy our body. We enjoy our body from outside. And dreams, ordinary chaotic dreams, are rightly interpreted if one says that they are the reflection of that bodily enjoyment which a person has in dreamless sleep. This explanation of sleep comes closer to the need for sleep that I spoke about in the case of the person with private means. For whereas it is not easy to believe that he is tired, we will have no difficulty in believing that he is so fond of his body that he would rather enjoy that than what often comes toward him from the outside world. He takes such endless pleasure in it, and enjoys himself so much, that he greatly prefers this than, say, a lecture that he listens to, perhaps out of a certain sense of shame, or a difficult piece of serious music, where he goes to sleep immediately, if he has to listen to it. Sleep is self-enjoyment. However, as in sleep, in normal sleep, we have the encounter with the spiritual world, sleep ceases to be mere self-enjoyment and becomes also a means of acquiring understanding of oneself to a certain degree, a process of self-discovery. In this respect, our spiritual training is really needed in order that people may come to understand that in normal sleep, they do indeed become immersed in the spiritual domain and re-emerge from it when they wake up again, and that they learn to approach this meeting with the Spirit with reverence. Now, in order that we are fully presented with the facts, I should like to return once more to the so-called enigma of fatigue, for anyone looking from a superficial standpoint might very well pick up on this point. Such a person may say that we really do experience feeling tired, and the need for sleep arises from this sense of tiredness. This is a point where a really clear distinction needs to be made. We do indeed become tired as a result of the day's work, and while we sleep, we are able to get over our fatigue. So this aspect of the matter is true. We are able to get rid of our tiredness through sleep. But sleep is not in any sense the result of tiredness, but consists in a person's enjoyment of himself. And through this self-enjoyment, he acquires the forces through which he drives away the tiredness that has arisen. Thus, to this extent, it is true to say that sleep can enable us to get over our fatigue. However, it does not follow that all sleep can do so. For whereas it is true that all sleep is self-enjoyment, it is not the case that all sleep drives away tiredness. For a person who sleeps unnecessarily, who goes to sleep at every opportunity, is really able to manage to go to sleep when there is no tiredness to be driven away, when nothing but self-enjoyment is involved. It is, of course, true that because one is accustomed through one's normal life to get over tiredness through sleep, one will, through a sleep of this nature, also constantly be making efforts to drive away one's sense of fatigue. But if there is no actual tiredness, as is the case with the person with a private income who goes to sleep in the concert, one will simply be busying oneself with one's body in the way that one would do if one were actually tired. As, however, there is no tiredness involved in this case, the person concerned will be busying himself unnecessarily, with the consequence that he incubates all sorts of ancillary conditions in the body. That is why these well-to-do people who sleep so much are tormented to such an extreme degree by all manner of conditions, known collectively as neurasthenia. Through one's connection with spiritual knowledge, it is possible to imagine a situation where one is conscious of living in a rhythm, where one is alternately in the physical world and in the spiritual world. In the physical world, one has encounters with outer physical nature. In the spiritual world, one meets with the beings who live in that world. We shall be able to understand this more fully if we study the entirety of man's being from a certain point of view. As you know, the science of biology normally views man as a unity, roughly dividing him into the head, chest region, and lower abdomen, with the various limb appendages. In those ancient times, when there was still an atavistic knowledge, people associated other ideas with this division of man's being. The great Plato, the Greek philosopher, attributes wisdom to the head, courage to the chest region, and the lower impulses of human nature to the lower abdomen. Moreover, what belongs to the chest region can be ennobled if wisdom is united with the courage that is linked to the chest region, thus becoming wisdom-filled courage, wisdom-filled activity. And if what may be regarded as man's lower part and is associated with the lower abdomen is irradiated with wisdom, Plato calls this prudence or circumspection, or quite literally a state of being clothed with the sun, S-U-N. Thus we see how the soul is divided and related to the various parts of the body. With the benefit of spiritual science, which was not as yet accessible to Plato in the same way, we can speak about these things in much fuller detail. As we are speaking about the whole of man's being, we will now, starting from the highest of his four members, speak about his ego. Everything that man calls his own in a soul spiritual sense works in his physical life between birth and death through the instrument of his physical body. With respect to each member of man's being, we can ask through which parts of the physical organism does the member in question work. What manifests itself to us through really thorough spiritual observation is that what we call the human ego is between birth and death, however strange it may seem, but the truth is usually very different from the way that a superficial awareness might imagine it to be, connected physically with what we call the lower abdomen. For the ego is, as I have often said, the baby of human nature. The physical body had its origins in the era of old Saturn, the ether body, and that of old Sun, the astral body, during the old moon period, and the ego during that of the earth. It is the youngest of the members of man's being. Only in the future period of Vulcan will it be at the stage where the physical body is now, during the earthly era. The ego is linked to the lowest part of man's physicality, and this lowest aspect is actually in a state of constant sleep. It is not organized in such a way that what takes place within it can be brought to consciousness. What is enacted in this lower region is, in ordinary waking consciousness, governed by sleep. We are just as little conscious of our ego as such in its true nature, its real essence, as we are of the processes of our digestion. The ego of which we are conscious is the image of what is reflected by way of our head. We do not ever really perceive our ego, neither in sleep, where we are normally completely unconscious, nor when we are awake, for the ego is then also asleep. The true ego does not come to consciousness. All that does so is the idea, the concept of the ego, which is reflected there. On the other hand, during the time between going to sleep and waking up, the ego really comes into its own, though someone who is in a normal state of deep sleep knows nothing of this, because he is still unconscious in this deep sleep during the earth era. So, the ego is, to all intents and purposes, connected with the lowest part of man's bodily organism. During the day, and for the duration of waking consciousness from within, and during sleep from without. If we now move on to the second member of human nature, to what we call the astral body, we find that as regards the instrument through which it works, the astral body is, from a certain point of view, connected with the chest region of man's being. In actual fact, we can really only dream about what goes on in the astral body and comes to expression through the region of the chest. Insofar as we are earthly human beings, we can perceive something of the ego only when we are asleep. That is to say, we cannot perceive anything consciously, whereas we can dream of what the astral body brings about within us. That is why we continually dream about our feelings, about the sentiments that dwell within us. Indeed, they lead a sort of dream life within us. Thus, the ego is outside the region that we human beings encompass with our ordinary sensory consciousness, for it is continuously asleep. The astral body is also still, in a certain respect, outside what we encompass with our sensory consciousness, for it can only dream. With respect to both of these, we are in reality in the spiritual world, irrespective of whether we are awake or asleep. What we call the ether body is, however, with regard to its physical aspect, connected with the head. Through the particular organization of the head, the ether body is able to remain constantly awake when it is within the human body, when it is connected with the physical aspect of the head. Thus we can say, the ego is connected with the lowest parts of our body, and the astral body with our chest region, the heart, the functioning of which lies outside our full consciousness, we have only a dream consciousness of it, beats and pulsates under the influence of the astral body. When the head thinks, it does so under the influence of the ether body. We can then, in addition, differentiate the physical body as a whole, where everything comes together, for its connection is with the entirety of the outside world. You can now see a remarkable set of relationships. The ego is connected with the lower parts of the body, the astral body with the heart region, the ether body with the head, and the physical body with the whole of the outside world, with the world around us. The physical body as a whole also has a relationship in waking consciousness with the surrounding outer world. In the same way that, with our whole body, we have a relationship with the external environment, so does our ether body have a connection with our head, our astral body with the heart, and so on. From this you can see how truly mysterious are the connections linking man with the world. These relationships are indeed virtually the opposite of what a superficial understanding of these matters might suppose. The lowest parts of human nature are at present the aspects of man's being which are as yet imperfect, and this is why they correspond, as parts of the body, to what we have referred to as the baby of our being, the ego. Infinite mysteries of human life lie hidden in what I have been saying to you. If you enter fully into all of this, you will, above all else, understand how the whole of man's being has been formed from the spirit, though at different stages. The human head is formed from the spirit, but its formation has been taken further. It belongs to a later stage of formation than does the chest, of which we might say that it is just as much a metamorphosis of the head as, in the sense of Goethe's theory of metamorphosis, the leaf is a metamorphosis of the flower. If we consider the rhythm between sleeping and waking, from this point of view, we may say that during our waking life, the ego actually dwells in all the lowest activities in the human body, which finally culminate in the formation of blood. The ego is present in these activities during the waking state. These are those activities of the body which are in a certain sense at the lowest level of spirituality. For everything to do with the body is also spiritual, even though what we are speaking about now is at the lowest spiritual level. However, through the fact that during waking consciousness, the ego is at the lowest level of spirituality. During sleep, and it is important to note this, it is with respect to man's being at the highest level of spirituality. 4. Consider the following. When we observe the head, and the way that we as human beings bear it on our shoulders, it is, as regards its outer form, the most fully a manifestation of the Spirit. It is to the fullest degree a reflection, a revelation of the Spirit. The Spirit has, in the head, entered most deeply into matter. For that very reason, it has left the least behind in the spirit world itself. Man has expended so much effort on making the outer form of the head a revelation of the Spirit that little has been left behind in the spiritual domain. Whereas, because what is outwardly manifested in the lower parts of man's physical organism is the least spiritualized, far more of what is related to these lower parts has been left behind in the world of spirit. The head, as head, has to the smallest degree a spiritual counterpart, because it has the most spirit within it. The lower abdomen has the greatest spiritual counterpart, because it has the least spirit within it. And in this greater abundance of spirit, which does not reside in the bodily organism, there dwells the ego during the hours of sleep. Just consider this wonderful balancing process. Whereas man has a lower nature with respect to his physicality, and the ego immerses itself in this lower nature at the moment of waking, this lower nature is only a lower nature because the Spirit has worked least upon it, because the Spirit has kept so much behind in the spiritual domain. And yet, during sleep, the ego is present in what has been kept back. Thus, during sleep, the ego is already now together with what man will develop and unfold only in the future. For it is at present only barely indicated and very little developed in man's bodily organism. Thus, when the ego becomes conscious of the situation in which it dwells during sleep, when it really becomes conscious of this situation, it may say to itself, quote, "During sleep, I am in the holiest situation that I can be in as a human being. And as I emerge from sleep, when I wake up, I am going from the world of my holiest situation to what is today only a feeble indication of it." Close quote. Yes, it is important that through spiritual science such things can really begin to live in our feelings, in our inner thoughts. Our lives will then themselves be imbued with a magical breath of holiness. We will then be able to associate a definite and positive idea or concept with what is called the grace of the Spirit, of the Holy Spirit. We will then connect this totality of human experience, which takes its course in the rhythm between sleeping and waking, with the idea, quote, "You may participate in the spiritual world. You may dwell in it." Close quote. When we have really taken this idea into our feeling life, quote, "You may be in the spiritual world. You will receive the grace of being imbued with the spiritual world, which is inaccessible to you through your ordinary consciousness." Close quote. When we have really lived with this thought, we have also learned to look up to the Spirit who is revealed to us, I might say, through every detail of life. And indeed, just as much as outer nature manifests itself to our outward eyes and ears. But the age of materialism has separated man from the consciousness of being irradiated and permeated in the totality of his existence by the grace of the Spirit. It is of immense importance that this is overcome. For in the depths of our souls we are more aware in our time of the prevailing materialism of our age than one might think. Nevertheless, the human soul is, in our present age, generally far too weak to bring these ideas which can lead beyond materialism to an inner awareness. One such idea is that of the holiness of sleep. For once we have understood this idea of the holiness of sleep, we ascribe all the thoughts and ideas in our waking state that do not bind us to matter to the influence of the spirit which follows during sleep. We would then be seeing what is important for us as human beings, not only in our waking state, which connects us with matter, which would be like considering that only winter is of any importance for the earth, but we would be seeing everything as a whole. For the earth we see the whole if we consider winter together with summer, and we see the whole for man if we consider the daytime, that is, the connection with matter, together with sleep, that is, the connection with the spirit. Now a superficial observation might say, quote, so when someone is awake, he is connected with matter and can therefore know something of the spirit even when awake? Close quote. Of course, man has a memory, and this memory functions not only in his consciousness, but also in his subconscious mind. If we had no memory, no amount of sleep could help us. This is very important, and I want you to keep it firmly in mind. If this were so, no amount of sleep could help us. For if we had no memory, we would be led inevitably to the firm belief that there is nothing but material existence. It is only because we preserve in our subconscious mind a memory of what we experience during sleep, even though we have no knowledge of this on the surface of our consciousness, that we think in a way that is not purely materialistic. If people do not only think materialistically, if they have spiritual ideas of any sort during the day, it is because they have a memory. For man is now constituted as an earthly human being in such a way that he comes in contact with the spirit only while he is asleep. The point at issue here is that if, on the other hand, we were to develop so strong a consciousness of what takes place within us during sleep, of the nature that, under certain circumstances, people in former times were able to develop, it would never occur to us to doubt the spirit, and we would, in contrast, remember what we encountered in our sleep, not only subconsciously, but also in a conscious way. If someone has had a conscious experience of what he lives through during sleep, it would be just as absurd to deny the spirit as it would be absurd for someone to deny the existence of tables and chairs while he is awake. The crucial point is that humanity should once more really come to appreciate the meeting with the spirit during sleep. This can only happen if the ideas and concepts developed during the day have sufficient force to make this possible. And this can be achieved by entering deeply into spiritual science. In spiritual science, we are working with ideas that are derived from the spiritual world. We discipline our head, that is to say, the ether body in our head, to conceive of things that do not have anything to do with outward materiality, and which have reality only in the world of spirit. A greater effort is needed for this than for forming mental pictures of things which have their reality in the material world. This is the real reason why people do not involve themselves with spiritual science. They come up with all sorts of reasons against it. They say that it is not logical. If they were urged to prove its illogicality, they would run into difficulties, for it cannot be proved that spiritual science is illogical. But the rejection of spiritual science, the refusal to acknowledge it, derives from something altogether different. Namely, that I'm not sure whether one may also be somewhat impolite in a scientific debate, from sheer laziness. And although certain learned people are ever so industrious when it comes to all the ideas that relate to outward, material things, with regard to the energy that one needs to apply in order to understand things of a spiritual nature, they are idle and lazy. and it is because they do not want to call forth in themselves the necessary energy that they do not acknowledge spiritual science. For it simply requires more effort to think spiritual scientific thoughts than to formulate ordinary ideas associated with material realities. Ideas of the latter nature arise out of themselves, whereas ideas that are not bound to the material world must be thought. One has to gather up one's forces and really make an effort. This reluctance to apply oneself is the reason for the rejection of spiritual science, and one has to realize this. But when the effort is made to assimilate such ideas and to think them through, one's soul enters into such a state of inner activity that it will gradually begin to develop a consciousness of what goes on between going to sleep and waking up, and of the meeting with the spirit that takes place then. A certain amount of unlearning of some ideas will surely be necessary. Just think to what a small degree many spiritual leaders today have the capacity to develop such ideas. Although the following scenario is less pronounced than it used to be, those who have now become leaders were, for the large part of their apprenticeship, or what one might call their student days, so deeply immersed in the life of their day that they learned to drink themselves into a stupor. Well, an idea and a whole wealth of feelings as to what goes on during sleep that such a person may develop are certainly not an appropriate way of clarifying the whole significance of sleep. One may be very learned as regards everything that is associated with matter, but it is naturally not possible for such a person to gain an insight into what one experiences between going to sleep and waking up. When people make the effort to think through ideas that are not connected with material substance, they develop an understanding of what I have called the first meeting, the meeting with the spirit during sleep. However, if the world is not to fall into decadence, it will be important for this understanding to shine into our lives with a sun-like radiance in the not-too-distant future. For if people do not take up these ideas, how will they be able to arrive at ideas of any kind? The only way they will be able to do this is by observing the outer world. However, ideas that are arrived at in this way alone leave the inner aspect of man's being, his soul, in a state of inertia. And what needs to exert itself through spiritual ideas is left inert, is unused and unfulfilled, and becomes degenerate. What is the consequence of this? The result is that people become blind to their whole relationship to the world, spiritually blind. By developing ideas and concepts under the influence of outer circumstances and impressions, they become spiritually blind. And spiritual blindness is the defining characteristic of the materialistic age. In science, this is only damaging up to a point. But in practical life, this blindness with regard to the real world is extremely harmful. You see, the further we descend into matter, the more things correct themselves in this materialistic age. If a bridge is being built, the people building it will be forced, by the circumstances involved, to adhere to the proper rules of construction. Otherwise, when the first vehicle crosses it, the bridge will collapse. It is more possible to apply erroneous ideas in the realm of medical care, for the reason that a person dies or is made well can never be proved. But it is by no means necessarily the case that the ideas acted upon were the right ones. However, in the world of ideas as such, and where one is active in the cultural domain, matters are far more serious. That is why things are looking really serious in what one generally calls the practical sciences, such as economics and politics. In the materialistic age, people have become used to being guided with respect to economics by ideas and impressions coming from the outer world, and as a result their ideas have become blind. Everything that is developed in the realm of economics consists for the most part of intellectually blind ideas. The inevitable consequence of this is that people who have these blind notions in their heads are carried along by events as though in leading reins. They allow events to take hold of them. And when in this state they become involved in them, the result is hardly surprising. This is the result of one of the ways in which one arrives at ideas without taking up spiritual science, namely that one's ideas are blind. The other approach to ideas is that, instead of being guided by outer circumstances, one's ideas are stimulated from within, which is to say that only what lives in one's emotions and passions is allowed to germinate in one's soul. This gives rise to ideas that are far from being blind, but are, one might say, of an intoxicating nature. And so people of the present day, who believe in materialism, are forever swinging to and fro between blind ideas and intoxicating ideas. Blind ideas, where they, in effect, let themselves be bossed around by what is going on, so that when they become involved, they do so in the clumsiest way possible. Intoxicating ideas, where they give themselves over solely to emotions and passions, and relate to the world in such a way that they do not really understand anything, but either love or hate everything, passing judgments in accordance with their love or hatred, their sympathy or antipathy. This is especially so in this materialistic age. For it is only by, on the one hand, making inner efforts to formulate spiritual ideas, and on the other hand, developing one's feelings for the wider concerns of the world, that a person arrives at ideas and conceptions that shed any light on anything. If we are able to embrace what spiritual science has to say to us regarding the wider connections with the ages of Saturn, Sun, and Moon, and our connection with the universe, which are ridiculed by people who uphold the modern materialistic conception of the world, if we can fructify our moral feelings through these wider purposes of humanity, we will reach beyond the mere emotions displayed in the form of sympathy and antipathy for everything in the world around us, and moreover, in the only way available to us. It is undoubtedly necessary for much that is living in our time to be purified through spiritual science. For man will not allow himself to be cut off so completely from the spiritual world. He does not really allow himself to be cut off, but only apparently so. I have already made you aware of how this apparent cutting off process is achieved. When, on the other hand, people swear only by matter and by the impressions of the outside world, the inner forces which are intended for the spirit remain within them. But they then direct them to a false realm and give themselves up to all manner of illusions. This is essentially why the most down-to-earth, materialistic people are also most prone to indulging in illusions. Thus we see many people who go through life denying the spirit and roaring with laughter if anyone speaks to them of someone having spiritual experiences. Quote, "He is seeing ghosts," close quote, they say, and they are uttering words of condemnation if they are able to say of someone that he is seeing ghosts. They certainly do not see ghosts, as they would say. But they only think that they do not see ghosts, because they are actually seeing them all the time. One can put such a person who is so firmly rooted in his crudely materialistic view of the world to the test, and one will be able to see how he indulges in the most extreme illusions as regards what the following day may bring. This giving way to illusions is merely a substitute for the realm of spirit, which he denies. He inevitably falls prey to illusions if he rejects everything of a spiritual nature, and he cannot avoid doing so. As has been said, it is not so easy to demonstrate the existence of illusions in the various areas of life. But they are all over the place, absolutely everywhere. And the thing is that people like illusions. One can, for example, very often come across someone saying, quote, "Shall I invest my money in this or that enterprise? This one is a brewery. I don't want my money being used for that, so I won't invest it here." Close quote. He takes his money to the bank. Without his knowledge, the bank invests the money in the brewery. It makes no difference whatsoever in the objective fact, but he is under the illusion that his money is not being used for such debased purposes. It might be thought that what I am saying is somewhat far-fetched. However, this is not so. It is a very common phenomenon. People today do not take the trouble to study life properly and penetrate its surface. It is, however, important to do this, for it is quite crucial that one should come to know what position one is in. This is not easy nowadays, because life has become complicated. Nevertheless, what I have been pointing out is true. For, you see, under certain circumstances, an absurd situation may easily arise. I shall illustrate this by means of an example. There was once an arsonist, I am giving you an actual instance, who ran out of a house that he had just set on fire. He had organized everything so that he was able to get away in time. He was caught and was held responsible. And then he said that he had done a really good job, for it wasn't his fault that the house went up in flames, but that of the workman who had just left the house, leaving a lighted candle glowing in the twilight. If the candle had burnt down during the night, the house would have gone up in flames in the middle of the night. He had therefore set the house on fire before it became totally dark. The house would have caught fire in any case, and he had only done what he did because if there was still some daylight when the house went up in flames, it would still be possible to put the fire out quickly. This would have been more complicated at night, and the whole house would have burnt down, whereas with some daylight the fire could be quickly extinguished. Then he was asked why he had not extinguished the candle. His reply was, quote, "I am a teacher of humanity. If I had blown the candle out, the workmen who were the ones to blame would have carried on, being careless. But now they can see what happens if they forget to extinguish the light." Close quote. We may laugh at such an example, but we fail to see that we are continually doing the same thing. People are constantly doing similar things to what this man did, when, instead of blowing out the candle, he set fire to the house. It is simply that we do not notice how a situation relates to the spiritual world, either because we are dulled by our feelings and passions, or because we are enticed by intoxicating ideas. If we become inwardly accustomed to the elasticity and flexibility that are necessary for the nurturing of spiritual ideas, we shall also develop our thinking in such a way that it can really penetrate into our lives and adapt itself to them. If we fail to do this, our thinking will never be able to deal with life, and will not even come in contact with it except in a superficial way. That is why, to turn to the deeper issue, the materialistic age really leads people away from all connection with the spiritual world. Just as one undermines one's bodily well-being if one does not sleep in the right way, so does one undermine one's soul life if one is not awake in the right way. And one is failing to be awake in the right way if one gives oneself up to outer impressions, if one lives without being conscious of one's connection with the spiritual world. Just as someone who, for one reason or another, tosses and turns in his sleep undermines his physical health, so does a person who in his waking hours gives himself up solely to his outward impressions of the world and to physical matter alone undermine his spiritual health. This will prevent him from rightly experiencing that first meeting with the spiritual world of which I have spoken. However, through this he ceases to be able to relate to the spiritual world in the right way during physical existence. And as a result, the connection with that world in which we are dwelling, when we are not incarnated in a physical body, that world which we enter when we pass through the portal of death, is severed. People need to understand once again that we are not here simply in order to involve ourselves in the physical universe during our physical existence, and that in the course of our whole existence we have a connection with the totality of the world. Those who have passed through the portal of death want to work with us on the physical world. This collaboration is only apparently of a physical nature, for everything physical is but an outward expression of the spirit. The materialistic age has estranged human beings from the world of the dead. Spiritual science needs to enable them to befriend this world once more. There will have to come a time when we no longer make it impossible for the dead to carry out their work for the spiritualization of the physical world by estranging ourselves from them. After all, the dead cannot take hold of things and affairs in the physical world with their hands and become directly involved in the physical work. That would be unthinkable. They are able to work in a spiritual way. For this, however, they need the tools that are available to them here. They need the spiritual substance that lives here in the physical world. We are not merely human beings. We are also at the same time instruments for the spirits who have passed through the portal of death. For as long as we are incarnated in a physical body, we use pens or hammers or axes. Once we are no longer incarnated in a physical body, our tools are human souls themselves. That this is so arises from the particular nature of a dead person's perception, which I should like to touch upon once more. I have already mentioned it earlier. Suppose you have before you, shall we say, a small vessel containing salt. As you look at it, you see the salt as white grains, as a white powder. But if you put the salt on your tongue and taste it, taste the distinctive quality of salt, it begins to be possible for the spirit to perceive it. Any spirit is able to perceive your tasting of the salt. Every spirit, and also every human soul that has passed through the portal of death, can perceive everything that takes place within man through the outer world. Just as nature reaches toward us when we taste and smell and see and hear, so does the world of the dead reach down to what we hear, see, taste, and so on. The dead accompany us in our experiences of the physical world. For these are not only part of our world, but also part of theirs. It belongs to their world when we imbue what we receive from the outside world with spiritual ideas. Unless we do this, what we merely experience as the effect of a material substance is as though incomprehensible to a dead person and is veiled in obscurity. A dead person experiences a soul that is estranged from the spirit as a dark soul. For this reason, the dead had become estranged from our earthly life during this materialistic age, and this situation must come to an end. There needs to be an intimate community of life between the so-called dead and the so-called living. However, this can happen only if people foster within their souls forces of a vibrant spiritual nature. That is, if they develop ideas, concepts, and imaginations which emanate from the spiritual domain. If a person makes the effort to reach the spiritual domain in his thoughts, he will gradually also reach the spirit in the realities of life. That is to say, a bridge is built between the physical and spiritual worlds. This alone can enable the transition to be made from the age of materialism to an age when human beings will confront reality neither in a blind nor an intoxicated way, but with vision and composure. These qualities will arise, on the one hand, through their capacity to see, as it were, with spiritual eyes, and on the other, through their ability to develop from their feelings, regarding the wider concerns of the world, a true balance between sympathy and antipathy, also with respect to what their immediate surroundings are demanding of them. The end of Lecture 5.